silence until the vid ran to the end.
"More,"
he said. Arulani keyed the next one. Yip again watched to the end. Again, without comment. Without waiting for another order, Arulani keyed in the next vid, then the next, switching from outside views to the ones her survey team had taken of the base's interior. That one finished, and she started to key up the fifth vid.
"No more,"
Yip said softly.
"I'm sorry,"
Arulani said, a bit surprised to realize she actually meant it.
"It's hard to watch your people being betrayed by an ally."
"How would you know?"
Yiv countered acidly.
"You Chiss have no allies."
"Perhaps not,"
Arulani conceded. So no denials, no complaints, no accusations. Did that mean her guess was correct? That Jixtus really was the one behind Yiv's campaign against the Ascendancy?
"That doesn't mean we don't have a great deal of experience with betrayal on a personal level."
"For a commander, it is always personal, is it not?"
Yiv smiled, his symbionts twitching again.
"Oh yes, I know who you are, Admiral Arulani of the Expansionary Defense Fleet. Tell me why you are here."
"To show you the evidence of Jixtus's betrayal."
"No,"
Yip said.
"Gloating is beneath you. Why are you here?"
"For information about Jixtus,"
Arulani said.
"We know he's working with the Kilchi Illumin."
Now for the second bluff.
"And the Agbui. Does he have other allies we don't yet know about?"
"The Agbui,"
Yip said contemptuously.
"Creatures of loud arrogance and silent uselessness, able to persuade a target merely into doing what he already wanted to do."
"They do have a high opinion of themselves,"
Arulani agreed, a shiver running up her back. Yiv could be as scornful as he liked, but Agbui uselessness had nearly pushed the Ascendancy into civil war.
"Are there others?"
"There are other names."
"Allies?"
"Perhaps,"
Yiv said.
"Perhaps simply names of those Jixtus encountered or had heard of. But even those names may yield useful results under careful analysis."
"Ah,"
Arulani said, eyeing him closely.
"And what will these names cost us?"
Yiv regarded her thoughtfully, the tips of his symbiont tendrils tracing out small patterns across his chest.
"You want more than simply names or species," he said. "You want times and locations of meetings and conversations. You want bits of information that were too vague or unrelated to Nicardoon triumphs for me to bother adding to my records."
The tendrils gave a final twitch, then settled back to their earlier slow undulation.
"You want everything there is to know about Jixtus and the Grisks."
Arulani felt her back stiffen. That was a species name she hadn't heard before.
"Jixtus's people are known as the Grisks?"
"Yes."
The cleft jaw cracked into a smile.
"That name was offered at no cost. The rest will have a price."
"What do you want?"
"I want to be free of this place,"
Yiv said without hesitation.
"I want to see the sun and the stars again. I want to feel the wind in my face and at my back. and to walk for more than 20 paces before encountering a barrier. I want life again!
You know we can't do that, General,
Aralani murmured, her heart sinking. So close, and yet so far.
Because you need me in custody to trade to the Nicardoon destiny when it threatens to overwhelm you?
Yiv turned to look at the wall display, where the last frozen image from Aralani's vid remained.
The destiny is no more. I know that.
He looked back at Aralani.
I have no fleet, no soldiers, no power. I'm not a threat to the Chiss. There is no reason you can't send me away.
I'm sorry, Aralani said. Even if we just moved you to a cell on the surface.
Do you not hear me?
Yiv demanded.
I do not wish to live any longer among the Chiss. Take me elsewhere. Leave me sufficient equipment and provisions to establish my home. And in return, I will tell you everything.
Aralani frowned.
Do you mean exile?
Of course,
Yiv said.
Is that such a difficult request?
No, not at all,
Aralani assured him. Though, actually it was. It was a hugely difficult request. As far as she knew, the Ascendancy had never exiled anyone. Certainly not within the scope of modern history.
I can't promise anything, but I'll speak to my superiors and see what they're willing to do, she said.
Just be certain to warn them that the time to act is limited,
Yiv said.
Jigstas is on the move, and the Chiss Ascendancy is his target.
They're more than aware of that,
Aralani assured him, stepping back to the door and giving the rap-rap, rap-rap signal she and her escort had agreed on.
She'll be informed of their decision.
Bakif was waiting in the prison command center when she arrived, sitting in front of a bank of displays.
Did everything come through all right?
She asked as she walked toward him.
Perfectly,
Bakif said, waving her to the chair beside him.
I thought he might try to keep his voice down so he could talk with you privately, but that didn't happen.
If anything, he kept his voice deliberately loud,
Aralani agreed.
I think he wanted all of us, you, me, and everyone else in here, in on the conversation.
Given the directions the talks went, I'm sure he did,
Bakif said.
What do you think of his offer?
It seemed genuine,
Aralani said, looking over the monitors. One of them was showing a silent replay of her conversation with Yiv, with overlays tracking the Nicardoon's subtle physical changes and extrapolating the parallel flow of mental and emotional states.
You're the ones who've been building up his truth fiction database. What did you see?
The same,
Bakif said grimly.
And that worries me.
Aralani frowned.
How so?
In the months since Thrawn brought him here, he's never once ever hinted at the possibility of a deal,
O'Keefe said.
What's the only thing that changed with your visit?
He trusts a Chiss Admiral more than a Chiss General,
Aralani suggested, trying for a bit of levity. O'Keefe shook his head.
He saw your evidence of his listening post's destruction.
Aralani felt her face warming, silently cursing her attempt at humor. She'd been so focused on the possibility of getting more information out of Yiv that the full implications of his offer hadn't registered.
He said Jigstas was on the move, she murmured. Yiv expects us to lose.
He does indeed,
Bakif said.
and he's trying to find a way off Chila before that happens.
Aralani nodded. Her stomach twisted into a hard knot. She'd gone into military service, expecting that the Chiss would be attacked on occasion, and that there would be corresponding ups and downs in its power and influence. But never in her life had the thought occurred to her that the Ascendancy might actually be destroyed by one of those enemies.
Of course, just because he believes it doesn't mean it's going to happen,
Bakeef pointed out.
But the fact that he does believe it means we need to take the possibility seriously.
Especially coming from someone who lost his own fight against us,
Aralani agreed.
What's the plan?
I'll contact the Council at once and get this thing rolling,
Bakeef said.
I have no idea what sort of equipment and provisions Yiv was referring to, but I'm sure he'll be happy to offer suggestions. We'll also get him busy listing all those names and other details he promised.
I notice you didn't mention the Syndicure, Aralani said. Aren't we going to tell them about this?
Not yet,
Bakeef said, his lip twisting.
You know the Aristocra. They'll want to debate it and haul us into hearings. And at the end, will probably tell us we can't do it. We don't have time for the process, and we can't afford that decision. We'll let them know when they need to, not before.
Yes, sir,
Aralani said, keeping her tone neutral. That wasn't how things were supposed to go, and they both knew it. Keeping the Syndicure in the dark that way could bring a galaxy of pain down onto Bakeef's head. But it was nothing compared with the pain that the fall of the Ascendancy would bring.
I understand, she added. I'd also recommend the Council formally call on the Nine to provide warships to strengthen the defense force.
Bakeef huffed out a sigh.
I can suggest it, he said. But I don't think the Council will follow through.
Aralani frowned.
Why not?
Because I strongly suspect several of the families will refuse the request,
Bakeef said bluntly.
The Dasklo and Klar, almost certainly. The Arisi and Ufsa, probably. The rest...
he shook his head.
I don't think the Council will want to aggravate tensions by forcing the Nine to choose between being allied and being loyalist.
I see,
Aralani said, hearing an edge of bitterness in her voice. Once again, politics were driving the fleet's agenda. This time, the politics of risking disaster in order to allow someone else to maintain appearances.
Are there any families who have declared themselves allied?
Yes, but unofficially,
Bakeef said.
Patriarch Thurfian has told the Council they can call on up to half the Myth fleet, and is in the process of deploying them to critical systems where they'll be instantly available if and when they're needed. Patriel Lacuni has also offered the frigate Midsummer, currently back at Selwys, though she warns us that the Defense Force would have to find officers and warriors to crew it.
Not much help.
No.
Bakeef agreed.
But better than nothing.
He stood up and gestured toward the door.
Come, I'll escort you back to the main level. I'll also make sure you get a full copy of the interview and our pattern analysis before you leave, in case you want to review it on the trip back to Spasia.
Thank you, sir.
They walked past the other officers on duty, then out through the command center's armored door. Bakeef nodded briskly to the armed warriors standing guard outside, gave a small, all-clear hand signal, and led the way down the corridor toward the elevators.
Don't look so glum, Admiral,
Bakeef said as he unlocked the control bar and keyed for the main levels and the less oppressive air far above them.
Just because the families are squabbling now doesn't mean a looming disaster. They'll come together as one when the crisis hits. It's happened many times in the Ascendancy's past, and it'll happen again.
I know, sir, Aurelani said.
Only she didn't know that. Not for certain. And she was pretty sure Lakeith didn't either.
The long-range comm conversation lasted longer than most of the calls that had taken place between Jixtus and his people during the Whetstone's voyage. The Grisk, at the other end, did most of the talking, which was also unusual, while Jixtus only made occasional comments. When it was finished, Jixtus sat quietly for over a minute, thinking or scowling or brooding behind his veil. Nakir watched him, wondering what the message had been and whether the news the other Grisk had delivered was good or bad. Actually, Nakir didn't have much doubt that it was the latter. Jixtus had never yet withdrawn into himself like this with good news. Always before, he had immediately shared it or boasted about it. No, something had gone wrong. Inevitable, really, though Jixtus still didn't recognize that. Only with true enlightenment did anyone achieve full wisdom and ability. And Jixtus's refusal to even consider the Kilji path meant his plans would always be bumpy and tangled. Perhaps the Grisk would someday learn that lesson. Nakir rather doubted it. The big question now was how this news would impact the Kilji's and their attempts to bring enlightenment to the Chiss and the other peoples of the Chaos. Finally, Jixtus stirred.
General Arius Nakir, we are taking a new direction, he said. Have your servants calculate a course for the Chiss world of Ornfra.
As you wish, Nakir said.
Jixtus had mentioned that system, but it had figured into one of the later stages of the Grisk plan.
Vassal 1, compute course to Ornfra.
I obey,
Vassal 1 said, and turned to his board.
So, we are no longer going to Sharb?
Nakir asked, eyeing Jixtus closely.
You said earlier that you wanted to draw more attention to the Zorlak.
That was earlier,
Jixtus said.
As I said, a new direction. The Zorlak are only minor players, as befits their status as one of the 40. The Klar and Dasklo are the focal points, and the key to inciting the 9 to civil war. When their simmering resentments have been forced into full combat, the rest of the Ascendancy will inevitably follow. Vassal, are you ready?
There was no response.
My vassals take orders only from me,
Nakir said calmly.
Vassal 1, execute course.
I obey.
The stars turned and melted, and the Whetstone was again in hyperspace.
You enjoy being master of your ship and your servants,
Jixtus commented.
Perhaps you enjoy it too much.
I enjoy it purely because it was through my efforts that these vassals became enlightened,
Nakir said.
You said when the Chiss have been forced into combat, the Ascendancy would fall. Would not the correct term be if?
Jixtus stirred again, the veiled face shifting a fraction to point directly at Nakir.
Do you question my words and my skill, Kilji?
He asked.
Or do you mock me? Because you should think long and deep before you step onto that path. You have no concept of the true power of the Grisks. We can crush the Illumin like boulders that can be turned to fine sand. Or we can twist your culture, your lives, and your very souls to do our bidding. Do not force me to choose which of those fates would be the more satisfying.
Nakir's skin again stretched.
No!
He said flatly. Jixtus seemed taken aback.
What do you mean, no?
I mean, you cannot twist us,
Nakir said.
We are the Enlightened. No falsehood of yours can lure us away from truth.
You may believe that if it comforts you,
Jixtus said.
Do you then choose for the Kilgis to be crushed to sand?
Perhaps even that is no longer within your power,
Nakir said, his skin stretching with daring. The inner turmoil he'd witnessed in Jixtus after the conversation with his fellow Grisks had left him at his lowest point yet. If he was like most species whom the Kilgis had encountered, this was the point where he would be most vulnerable to enlightenment. But that was not the immediate goal here. Enlightenment would come once the Grisks were comfortable with the Illumin and their emotional defenses had been lowered. Now was the time to start down the road to that ultimate end.
Tell me, what was the news just now that so upset you?
I never said I was upset.
Your silence and subdued attitude said it for you,
Nakir said.
Your problem, Jixtus, is that you see the Kilgis as minor tools to be used at the edges of your ambition. You stated that yourself. We were merely to conquer small nations so as to close them off to chiss retreat.
And you would then be free to meddle in their culture and bring them enlightenment,
Jixtus said.
That was what you wanted, wasn't it?
It was, and still is,
Nakir agreed.
But it's not all we want.
For a moment, Jixtus was silent.
Very well,
he said.
Tell me of this new ambition.
You look only to destroy the Chiss,
Nakir said, with cautious anticipation. Jixtus was listening to him. For the first time, he was actually listening to him.
I look instead to put them alongside us as your allies.
That attempt has already been made,
Jixtus growled.
We selected the most malleable of their leaders and inflamed their desires past the abilities of rational thought. It failed.
Because you misunderstood them,
Nakir said.
You inflamed their desires, and now you inflame their fears and rivalries. What if, instead of fear, they could be induced to work cooperatively for the glory of the Grisks?
Through the enlightenment of the Kilgis?
Jixtus gave a sort of low, snorting sound.
You reach now beyond your abilities, General Arius.
Not at all,
Nakir said.
All beings secretly dream of having someone to give them order and purpose, who will allow them to serve without the need for burdensome thought or uncertain decision. That is the enlightenment we offer.
No,
Jixtus said firmly.
You may have the remnant once we have broken the Ascendancy's back, but its back will be broken. Even now, the fuse is lit, and the first explosion of a civil war is set.
He gestured toward the viewport.
Would you like to see the beginning of their end?
Nakir stretched with deep frustration. Jixtus was listening, but he wasn't hearing. He still didn't understand what the Kilgi Illumin offered, or what the Kilgi Enlightenment could do to a people like the Chiss. No matter. There were other nations besides the Chiss in the chaos. Nations the Grisks surely hoped to turn into that fine sand Jixtus had threatened him with. And once that was accomplished, there was all of Lesser Space and the beings inhabiting it. There would be time for Nakir to show Jixtus the full scope of what the Enlightened could do. And if not Jixtus himself, then perhaps his successor. Even Grisks, after all, presumably didn't live forever. And then the Kilgis' would-be masters would finally accept the Illumin as full partners in their dominion of the galaxy.
I would like to see that, yes,
he told Jixtus.
It is to be at Ornfra.
It is,
Jixtus said.
We will travel one more hour. Then you will return the ship to Star Space so that I may make one final call.
Of course,
Nakir said with sudden doubt. If he'd pressed his petition too hard, that call might be to that terrible Grisk warship. In the shadow of his thoughts, he saw boulders being reduced to dust.
Have no fear, General Arius,
Jixtus said, in a voice that was both soothing and mocking.
Truthfully, I was impressed by your passion for joining the Grisks as equals. It's a topic we shall revisit when the Chiss lie dead at our feet.
He gestured.
And this call you will be welcome to listen in on. It will be to the Klar family warship, Orison.
Nakir felt a stretch of annoyance. He should have guessed Jixtus's call would be to his tame Chiss.
I dislike having to tie our travels to this person and her schedule,
he said.
When will we be done with her?
When she has served her full purpose,
Jixtus said.
Tell me, General Arius Nakir of the Enlightened, when do you think that will be?
Nakir considered.
I think it is now,
he said.
You speak as if your plan is fully underway. I believe we can now let her go.
Interesting,
Jixtus said.
Perhaps you do indeed have enlightenment.
Nakir eyed him closely.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that as you were there for her beginning with us, so shall you be there for her end,
Jixtus said.
I will speak with her one more time, and then we shall travel to Ornfra and witness her death.
She will die?
She will.
Jixtus paused, and Nakir could imagine a malicious smile behind that veil.
And with her death will come the end of the Chiss Ascendancy.
Roscu had never liked schedules. They were fine for other people, but not for her. She had the rare combination of professionalism and instinct that allowed her to recognize and take advantage of unexpected opportunities. Options that would be stifled by an inflexible schedule. But in this case, it was a necessary evil. With ships traveling in hyperspace, unable to communicate with one another or the universe in general, and with the Orison and Whetstone both roaming around the Ascendancy on their individual tasks, the only way she could keep up to date on anything Jixtus learned was for both of them to commit to being in space normal at certain specific times. It could be annoying and disruptive of her plans, but sometimes it paid off. This time, it paid off very well.
I apologize for calling at this hour, Your Venerante, Roscu said. But I had news I needed to pass on to you.
Not a problem, Captain,
Patriarch Rivlex assured her.
I assume you've heard about the battle at Saus between the Tamai and Droke.
Yes, I picked up the news feed when I stopped to talk to Jixtus,
Roscu said, wrinkling her nose a little. Personally, she wouldn't call a few laser shots exchanged between armed freighters a battle. Even skirmish would be pushing it.
It sounds like the Bellicose was able to intervene before things got out of hand.
Yes, but that's not really the point,
Rivlex said.
If even minor families are starting to shoot at each other, we could be on the edge of a disaster.
Roscu rolled her eyes. And then there were people who went all drama at the slightest provocation. She hated that even worse than she hated schedules.
Has the Council called on the Nine for support? She asked.
No, not yet.
Well, then they probably aren't all that worried about it.
Or they know that Patriarch Cloy Versi will refuse to contribute,
Rivlex said.
And I can tell you right now, that if the Dasklo don't hand over any of their ships, we certainly won't.
Yes, probably a prudent move,
Roscu said. Yet more drama. Still, he might have a point. The Council might have already done some quiet probing, concluded that not enough of the Nine would contribute to overall Ascendancy defense, and decided a call would simply exasperate the situation.
But that's not why I called, she continued. While I was picking up the news, I also heard from Jixtus. It seems that while we're focused on the Dasklo, the Myth are quietly making a move against the whole Ascendancy.
Wait a moment,
Rivlex said.
You said the Myth?
Yes, Roscu said. You'll recall that the Zodlak, Pomrio, and Erigal claimed they went to Hoxim because there was supposedly a largely untapped Nyx mine there.
Eventually, they claimed that.
Yes, fine. It took them a while to come clean, Roscu said, fighting down her annoyance.
Rivlex had a bad habit of bringing up irrelevant details when he should be listening.
At any rate, Jixtus says that the Myth have found the actual planet the Nyx jewelry came from. A planet that has incredibly rich deposits.
She paused for emphasis.
He also says that a group of aliens led by Senior Captain Thrawn are already in the process of capturing it, with a plan to claim it for the myth.
Interesting,
Riblex said, not sounding nearly as troubled by this news as he ought to be.
Does Jixtus have a name and location for this planet?
He doesn't know the actual name, Roscoe said. Thrawn has apparently codenamed it Sunrise. But I do have its location.
And you believe him?
Roscoe frowned. What kind of question was that?
Don't you?
I don't know,
Rivlex said.
That's why I ask. You're the one who's been in closest contact with this alien. Have you found his previous information reliable?
Yes, Your Venerante, I have,
Roscoe said firmly.
More than that, this is exactly the sort of underhanded move Thrawn would pull.
Perhaps,
Rivlex said, clearly still not convinced.
Tell me about these aliens he supposedly recruited.
They're called the Pakosh, from the Rapok system,
Roscoe said.
The names are in our data files, though there's not much detail. Thrawn first contacted them when he was searching for the origin of the refugees who were trying to get to Dioya when they were attacked and killed.
Yes, I remember,
Rivlex said.
That was the mission that also led to the discovery and identification of General Yiv, was it not?
Yes, it was,
Roscoe confirmed, scowling at the comm. This was urgent and dangerous news. Why was the Patriarch dragging his feet with irrelevant questions?
The point is that while we're all looking and now shooting at one another, the Myth are poised to reach a level of power that hasn't been seen since the Stibla handed over their rule to the first three ruling families.
I think you may be overstating the case, Captain,
Rivlex said mildly.
Granted, a rich source of Nyx would buy the Myth a great deal of prestige in the Sindicure, but it would hardly translate to the kind of power you're talking about.
With all due respect, Your Venerante, I think you may be forgetting Myth history,
Roscoe said stiffly.
That gravity well generator they brought back from Thrawn's first encounter with the Vagari pirates was what finally persuaded the Abek to ally with them. The enhanced energy shield they found at the edge of Lesser Space brought them a complete pass on Thrawn's blatant violation of standing orders, and also took the Krovi out of the Arisi list of allies and turned them neutral. And let's not forget the Myth's cozy connection with the Stibla.
What are you referring to?
Rivlex asked, his tone gone all cautious and guarded.
You know what I'm referring to, Your Venerante,
Roscoe said.
The point is that after the Hoxim incident, I'm told Thrawn ignored the order to come to Chila and instead went directly to Spasia and a meeting with Stibla Patriarch Lamiov. There's no reason for him to have done that unless he was bringing something new to the UAG. And in that case, he should have first presented it to the Council. He certainly shouldn't be showing it first to a Patriarch of one of the 40.
I can see that. Yes,
Rivlex agreed, the moment of strange caution disappearing from his tone.
I'll see what I can find out about that. I presume you're still on your way to Ornfra?
Yes, to take a look at the Krolling Sen shipyard, Roscoe confirmed. One more thing. Jixtus also warned that the Myth have an observation and communications post hidden inside an artificial asteroid shell that may have been deployed into the Ornfra system.
That sounds like an awful lot of effort to go to,
Rivlex said.
Especially when everyone else just uses freighters or transports to keep track of their rivals.
Freighters and transports are too obvious for someone like Thrawn,
Roscoe said sourly.
Or did you forget that Jixtus told us the vid of the Dasklo incident was taken in the Ornfra system?
Of course I didn't forget.
Rivlex broke off.
Are you suggesting the Myth are the ones who recorded that vid? And then what? Sold it to Jixtus?
Why not?
Roscoe said.
Clearly the Dasklo didn't know they were being recorded. A fake asteroid drifting along, watching their war games? Who would have suspected something like that?
But if the recording came from the myth, why didn't Jixtus tell us?
He probably doesn't know himself where it came from, Roscoe said. You have to look at the larger pattern of Thrawn's behavior. He's already working with one alien species to grab the Sunrise Nyx mines, and we know he also made some kind of private deal with the Patatis during his latest pirate hunt.
The Sindicure seemed pleased enough with that last one.
Who is or is not pleased is irrelevant, your Veterante, Roscoe persisted. I'm talking about how Thrawn uses aliens for his own purposes. In fact, now that I think about it, he practically started his career that way, manipulating the Garweans and Leoaoi. So why not Jixtus too? What's one more alien for him to lie to?
Well, you know him better than I do,
Rivlex said, still sounding like he didn't want to believe it.
Just be careful not to make any public accusations until you have solid evidence.
Don't worry, your Venerante, Roscoe said as patiently as she could. I'll let you know what I find at Ornfra.
Very good, Captain,
Rivlex said.
And be careful. Patriarch Rivlex out.
The comm pinged off.
Or should I say I'll let you know what I catch the Dasklo doing?
She added under her breath.
Orders, Captain?
Commander Ramis asked, stepping to the side of her command chair.
Back into hyperspace, and continue on to Ornfra, Roscoe told him. Best possible speed.
Yes, ma'am.
Ramis gestured across the bridge.
Helm, reinitiate course to Ornfra.
Acknowledged, Commander,
the pilot said briskly. Outside the viewport, the stars stretched into star flares, then faded into hyperspace swirl.
On course for Ornfra, Captain,
Ramis said formally.
Any further orders?
Not right now, Roscoe said. You're relieved for now, but I'll want you on the bridge when we reach Ornfra.
Yes, ma'am.
Ramis paused.
Captain, did you notice something odd in the Patriarch's voice when you mentioned the myth and the Stibla?
Maybe a little,
Roscoe said, keeping her voice casual. There was nothing odd about Rivlex's reaction, as far as she was concerned. Clearly he'd been remembering the fiasco with Thrawn and that Stibla senior aide at the alien world Plecnok. But that incident had been deeply and deliberately buried, and Roscoe had no intention of digging it up now.
Maybe he was thinking about the fact that the myth routinely hand over any alien artifacts they find to the Stibla.
I thought everyone did that.
Mostly,
Roscoe said. Actually, he was right. Everyone did hand over alien artifacts to the Stibla, but only in the sense that the Stibla ran the UAG, and all such items were examined by that agency before being dispersed elsewhere.
Or maybe he was thinking about the old theory that the two families worked a treasonous deal with the invaders during the final assault on Chila.
Ramis smiled.
I doubt the Patriarch's worrying about thousand-year-old stories Academy cadets tell each other when they don't feel like studying, he said. Especially stories that don't hold air. Can't be much of an alliance when the invaders end up dead, and the myth and Stibla don't end up dead beside them.
Or even censured by everyone else, Roscoe said. It was just a thought. Probably he just hadn't had his caco leaf yet.
That's probably it, Ramis said.
He hesitated.
One more thing, Captain, if I may. Forgive me if I'm out of line, ma'am, but I'm wondering about Admiral Arulani.
Roscoe felt her stomach tighten.
You mean why she and I don't get along?
Yes, ma'am, Ramis said. I know it's none of my business,
but with the ramped up tensions we're seeing in the Ascendancy. You need to know what might get in the way of cooperation with other Ascendancy forces. Roscoe finished for him. Fair enough. All right. A few years ago, Aralani was my commander aboard the patrol ship Parala when we happened on a pirate attack against a Garwian merchant hub station. The Garwians were losing when suddenly they switched to new tactics that saved the day. I suspected those tactics were illegally given to them by our fourth officer, Senior Commander Thrawn, and I lodged a complaint against him. What happened? Nothing at all, Roscoe said, forcing her voice to remain steady. The incident belonged to the distant past, and she'd already dredged up more of its emotional coloring recently than was good for her. Aralani covered for Thrawn. Supreme General Bakeev covered for Aralani, and the whole thing was swept out the door. I see, Ramis said. Is that when you left and joined the Klar family forces? It was a couple of months later, Roscoe said. But yes, I was ready to leave. The Patriarch offered me a position, and I took it. End of story. I see, Ramis said. Thank you, Captain. I appreciate your honesty. You're welcome, Commander, Roscoe said. Senior officers shouldn't have secrets from each other. I agree, Ramis said. Thank you again for your time. I'll see you when we reach Ornfra. For a minute after he left the bridge, Roscoe sat quietly in her chair, her eyes doing the methodical sweep of stations and status boards that her years in the fleet had ingrained in her. No. The captain and first officer shouldn't have secrets between them. Unless those secrets were dark and shameful. Such as the true reason Roscoe had left the expansionary defense fleet. Not out of some high-minded protest against Thrawn and Aralani, but because a month after the Garwian incident, Roscoe had herself been brought up on charges for a minor protocol infraction. It had been a small lapse, certainly far milder than the crime Thrawn had committed. Only in her case, no one came to her defense. No one worked tirelessly to clear her name. In the end, all they did was offer her the choice between official discipline and quiet departure. She'd chosen the latter, and had never regretted it. And then had come Plecnok. Roscoe glowered at the displays, feeling a trickle of the old emotions seeping through, despite her efforts to suppress them. The fact that the Klar had emerged from that incident more or less intact didn't matter. The fact that no one had died and the family had even managed to save face didn't matter. What mattered was that the Myth and the Stybla knew the truth about Plecnok. They knew what her part had been, and they knew how she'd failed. Just like she'd failed to hold on to a position in the expansionary defense fleet. Worst of all, Thrawn knew. There was a score there that needed to be settled between her family and Thrawn's. Maybe today, at Ornfra, Roscoe would finally have the chance to do so.
Memories. 9.
Prepare,
Thrawn said.
Pilot. 3, 2, 1.
With a sudden surge of power, the Jandalin twisted off its vector, angling to the right in a tight curve that had Thras grabbing for his restraints. The starscape outside spun madly as the patrol ship continued its turn. And he could feel the rumbling vibration beneath him as the pilot ran the thrusters back to full power. For a second, he could see the approaching Patatis formation straight ahead of them. There was a sort of soft chuff, and then the pilot continued their curve, turning the ship back toward the crippled pirate. There was a muted flash as the Jandalan spectrum lasers fired again. Lepinsick muttered something that sounded like a curse. What? Thras asked. He looked among the various displays, trying vainly to figure out what Lepinsick was seeing and wishing he knew better how to read the data. Had Thrawn taken out one of the alien gunboats? Or maybe even the frigate?
He fired at the transport again,
Lepinsick said tightly.
What in...
He broke off as the ship abruptly reversed the direction of its turn, again briefly facing off against the Patadas ships, which were significantly closer now, Thras noted uneasily, before continuing on again out of their path.
Another right-hand curve,
this one slightly less fierce than the last ones, and then the pilot straightened them out onto a vector that showed nothing but stars ahead. Thras again looked at the displays, and this time was able to at least see that the pirate ship was behind them and that the Jandalan was now running parallel to the squadron of incoming Patadas ships, only in the opposite direction. He frowned. Paralleling the Patadas? Moving past them within easy attack range? Yet none of the aliens was making any move against them.
Thrawn!
He called.
What's going on?
Exactly what I expected,
Thrawn said, a new and subtle note of confidence in his voice.
Something else I deduced from the records of the previous Patadas battle.
Which is?
Lepinsick asked impatiently. Thrawn pointed to the side, out the viewport.
Patadas tactics are based on a swarm mentality, he said. You see how they're now opening up their cluster as they continue toward the transport?
Thras studied the displays. He hadn't noticed the change in formation before, but now that he knew to look for it, could see that Thrawn was right.
But why the transport?
Lepinsick asked.
We're already in laser range. The transport isn't. Why not attack us?
Because part of their pattern is to go after the weakest target first,
Thrawn said.
To swarm it, destroy it, then move on to the next target.
Wait!
Lepinsick cut him off, suddenly horrified.
To destroy it? Thrawn, we need that ship intact. You can't...
He broke off as the Jandalan again turned into a tight curve that once again had Thras grabbing for his safety straps.
Thrawn!
Lepinsick shouted over the roar of the thrusters. Thrawn didn't answer. The curve straightened out, and Thras once again saw the Patadas ships directly in front of them. But unlike the last two times he'd seen the aliens, this time they weren't blazing toward the Chiss patrol ship. This time, they were blazing away from them. Thrawn's last maneuver had brought the Jandalan into position directly behind the attack formation. And even as Thras belatedly realized that all the twisting and turning had been about getting the Jandalan into precisely this position, the ship's three spectrum lasers opened fire. The closest of the Patadas gunboats took the full impact of the barrage. And on the sensor display, Thras saw a warning cone appear as the lasers dug deeply into the alien's main thrusters. Thras watched closely, wondering if the next salvo would destroy the craft completely, or whether it would take a third or even a fourth attack to achieve that end. But destruction was apparently not Thrawn's goal for this battle. His second laser blast wasn't directed at the damaged Patadas ship, but instead focused on the next nearest gunboat. Another triple laser blast, and Thrawn again changed targets, this time to the third nearest. Even as he fired, the Jandalan was again in motion, accelerating toward the farther wing of the opening Patadas formation. Yet Thras hadn't heard Thrawn give any additional orders. Did that mean the pilot was still following the original course pattern? If so, had Thrawn really anticipated the battle this far in advance? Thras looked at the display again, concentrating on the one showing the distant transport. It was all well and good to pick off the gunboats one by one from behind while they were focused on a different target. But that strategy had now left the disabled Chiss transport completely exposed to the alien forces arrowing in on it. The frigate was still there. Two of the swarming gunboats were still undamaged. He stiffened. Had that been a flash of laser fire from the frigate? There was no indication of any fresh damage to the transport, but Thras was certain he'd seen a flash. And then, even as he tried to figure it out, the gunboat moving along the frigate's port side flank sparked a small flash of its own. What in the name of Chila?
Pilot, ahead full power, Thrawn ordered,
his voice calm but with an edge of urgency to it.
Get me an optimal laser range of the frigate.
Yes, sir,
the pilot said, his words disappearing into the suddenly enhanced roar of the Jandalan's thrusters.
As you see, Thras, Thrawn said, half turning toward Thras and raising his voice to be heard over the noise. The target of a Kriplinet doesn't have to be motionless if you can drop it in front of him and persuade him to run into it.
Yes, Thras murmured.
So that was what the twin flashes had been. The frigate and gunboat slamming into the pair of charged nets that Thrawn had earlier dropped in their path, with all the twists and turns designed to hide their release from the Patatis. Only in order to make it work, Thrawn had had to not only precisely anticipate the swarming tactic, but also predict with a high degree of accuracy the vectors the individual alien ships would travel on their way to the transport. Just like he'd apparently anticipated the maneuvers that would be needed to get the Jandalan behind the attack force. And all he'd had to go on was the data from a single battle 19 years ago? Thras stared at the back of Thrawn's head, a chill running up his back. What kind of person could do all that?
Fortunately, Kriplinets are large, Thrawn commented, as if anticipating Thras's thoughts and concerns. They're nearly impossible to detect, certainly at warship attack speeds, and they don't have to hit their targets squarely in order to temporarily disrupt their systems.
Impressive aiming, nonetheless, Lapin-6 said. What now?
We retrieve the transport and their hijacked cargo and leave, Thrawn told him. Observe the Patatis ships.
Thras again looked at the displays. The gunboats had broken off their attack. The ones Thrawn had fired on, limping away from the transport with the clear intent of making their escape into deep space. The single undamaged gunboat had joined with its partially paralyzed comrade and were together nudging the semi-incapacitated frigate off its attack vector toward a similar departure.
Senior at Lapin-6, the pilot called over his shoulder. We're coming within laser range of the Patatis frigate. Do we attack?
Meet Commander Thrawn, Lapin-6 asked.
As Syndic Thras rightly pointed out earlier, we can hardly hope to stand face to face against 6 warships who've been forced to continue hostilities, Thrawn said. If the Patatis have reconsidered their course of action, I see no reason not to let them go.
He pointed toward the left-hand side of the viewport.
Of more concern right now is Captain Roscoe.
Thras felt his throat tighten. The Orison, which had been hanging well back from the field of battle, was again in motion, driving toward the hijacker's transport. With the danger now past, Roscoe apparently thought she could just swoop in and pluck the cargo out of the Jandalan's fingers.
Pilot, emergency power to the drive, Lapin-6 ordered grimly. Get us to the transport ahead of the Klar.
Yes, sir, the pilot said.
The roar of the thrusters increased even more, and Thras felt a brief twitch as the Jandalan leapt forward.
Arriving ahead of the Orison may not give us anything, Thrawn said over the noise. Captain Roscoe has more than enough weight of weaponry and personnel to force us away.
Just get us there, Lapin-6 growled. Rosco wouldn't dare block the senior aide to a patriarch of the 40 by force.
Under the circumstances, I'm not sure there's anything she wouldn't dare, Thrawn warned. But perhaps we can persuade her to reconsider.
The Orison was steadily picking up speed, as Rosco likewise pushed her cruiser's drive to its limit. But the ship's more powerful thrusters also had to contend with the ship's greater mass, and the computer's projection still showed the Jandalan reaching the transport first.
Pilot, on my mark, you will execute emergency braking, Thrawn said.
Thras frowned. Interrupting the Jandalan's forward momentum would slow them down and possibly give the Orison the advantage necessary to reach the transport first.
On my second mark, resume course and acceleration, Thrawn continued.
Thrawn?
Thras said, and stopped at a cautionary gesture from Lapinsick.
Let him go,
the senior aide said, just loudly enough for Thras to hear over the thruster noise.
I think he's more than demonstrated he knows what he's doing.
Thras ground his teeth, but nodded. The Jandalan continued on.
Pilot, first mark. 3, 2, 1,
Thrawn said. Thras felt the slight surge as the Jandalan's forward thrusters went into full braking mode, killing some of the ship's acceleration. He clenched his hands around his safety straps, wondering what game Thrawn was playing at now.
Second mark. 3, 2, 1.
Once again, Thras felt a small twitch of acceleration as the compensators lagged slightly behind the surge of the main thruster's emergency power. The Jandalan again leapt forward, and he looked back at the displays, wondering if Thrawn's baffling maneuver had cost them the race to the transport. He was still trying to figure it out when the glow of a plasma sphere sizzled past the viewport across the Jandalan's bow.
Thras jerked, feeling his mouth drop open.
What in the...
Rosco fired on us,
Lapinsick said, his voice hovering somewhere between disbelief and fury.
She fired on us.
As I said, Thrawn called back to them. There's little she wouldn't dare.
How did you know?
Thras asked.
About the plasmasphere?
Thrawn gave a little shrug.
I served with her. I know how she thinks and behaves.
And you knew she would attack us?
I suspected she would try to disable us, Thrawn said. She probably reasons that once she has the transport and its cargo, there's nothing we can do about it.
Thras mouthed a curse.
Thrawn was right on that one, anyway. The Stibler could file a complaint once the Jandalan was back in the Ascendancy, but in the meantime, the Klar would have the transport and the cargo. The cargo that belonged to the Stibler. The cargo that Lapinsick and Patriarch Lamiov were desperate to retrieve. The cargo Rosco was going to simply walk away with. He squared his shoulders. Like hell she was.
Are you saying there's nothing we can do to stop her?
Lapinsick demanded.
He's not saying that at all,
Thras said before Thrawn could answer.
The comm, if you please.
Lapinsick sent him a brief, speculative look. Then, without comment, he pulled the comm speaker from its holder and handed it over.
Thank you,
Thras said.
Pilot, communications, if you please.
You have come,
the pilot confirmed.
Thank you.
Thras keyed the mic.
Orison, this is the Jandalan,
he said.
Captain Rosco, you should be aware that someone under your command has just committed a serious violation of Ascendancy law. As I assume you know, launching an attack on a member of the Sindicure can be considered an act of internecine war. I'm sure your Patriarch would be shocked to hear that someone aboard your ship has been careless enough to put him in that position.
Don't be ridiculous,
Rosco's scornful voice came back.
You already identified yourself as nothing more than a senior aide.
Attacking a Patriarch's senior aide is also a serious breach of protocol, Thras said. But this isn't senior aide Lapinsick. You're talking to Syndic Mithrasophis. I suggest you think long and hard before you continue along your current path.
There was a short pause.
You're lying,
Roscoe accused.
Why would a Myth Syndic be aboard a Sidler patrol ship?
For the same reason Mid-Commander Thrawn is aboard, Thras said,
an odd thought suddenly occurring to him. Family relationships were sometimes vague and always complicated, and the perceptions of those relationships were often even more so. But if properly presented, erroneous perceptions could be useful, providing leverage and manipulation in a way that couldn't later be denounced as outright falsehoods. Thras, as a Myth cousin, had some of the same rights and privileges as those enjoyed by blood. And one of those rights, he knew, was to make personal declarations of...
My brother and I were asked by our Patriarch to assist Senior Aide Lapinsick in his recovery operation, he continued, dropping the critical word into the conversation with a casual familiarity, as if he'd referred to the relationship 1,000 times over the years.
The question now was whether Roscoe would catch the designation and the significance he hoped she would place on it. From the length of the silence at the other end of the comm, it appeared that she had.
This operation is a matter for the Klar,
Roscoe said at last. Quietly, Thras let out the breath he'd been holding.
Retrieval of the cargo is a matter for the Stibler, he countered.
As he'd hoped, Roscoe had taken the most literal meaning of his comment. And really, it would have been extraordinary if she hadn't. She didn't know Thrawn's standing with the Myth. She would assume he was a merit adoptive, as were most of the Nine's military personnel, but would never have been so crass as to ask. Now that lack of definitive information had turned around to sting her. Syndics were always either blood, cousins, or ranking distance, and Thras's identification of Thrawn as his brother strongly implied that he, too, was in that lofty peak of the Myth family pyramid. Roscoe might be willing to kill a Stibler Patriarch's senior aide, especially if she could make it seem like a result of the brief battle with the Patatis. Killing a high-ranking Myth, on the other hand, would be far more dangerous. Killing 2 high-ranking Myth should be completely out of the question, especially if she could be persuaded that she wasn't the only one on her end of the conversation.
One other thing, Thras said. Be advised that we're currently copying these transmissions to the transport. Whatever course of action you decide on, your Klar family hijackers will be witnesses to it.
Impossible,
Roscoe insisted.
The plasmasphere we fired earlier will have knocked out their comm.
I didn't say we were using the comm, Thras said. Mid-Commander Thrawn has retuned one of the Jandalan's lasers to a comm frequency, and is feeding the transmissions through the transport sensor network.
There was another brief pause. Then Roscoe bit out a curse Thras had never heard in polite society.
I knew it,
she snarled.
I knew he'd meddled in that pirate attack.
On the contrary, Thras said.
Thrawn had half turned in his seat, Thras noted, a rather stunned look on his face. Thras gave him a reassuring smile in return.
Just because he knows how to do something doesn't imply he's ever actually done it.
Syndic Thras!
At any rate, right now your focus needs to be on your own situation.
Thras cut her off.
As I see it, your only option is to withdraw gracefully.
You don't understand, Syndic!
Roscoe said. the anger and frustration in her voice edging toward veiled desperation.
I have orders! I cannot return without the hijackers!
Then take them,
Lapin Six spoke up. Thras looked at him in surprise.
Excuse me?
Lapin Six gestured for the mic. Frowning, Thras handed it over.
Captain Roskull, this is Senior Aide Lapin Six,
Lapin Six said.
If all you want are the hijackers,
you're welcome to them.
All we want is our cargo.
Once it's aboard the Jandalin, we'll withdraw, and you can do as you please with both the transport and the criminals.
Thras felt his eyes narrow. Was Lapin Six really authorized to make that sort of deal?
Of course he was.
Patriarch Lamiov had already said he'd tried to work a deal with Patriarch Rivlex to avoid a crisis between their two families. Bringing a group of Klar hijackers back to Naperar would force the dangerous confrontation Lamiov had always hoped to avoid.
Captain?
Lapin Six prompted.
I suppose that would be acceptable,
Roskull growled.
I would hope so,
Lapin Six said, his voice going dark.
Because otherwise, you're going to get nothing at all. So here's what you'll do. First, you'll break off your rush and take a position 300 kilometers from the transport. You'll then transmit an order that we can record and play for the hijackers after we've docked, instructing them to leave all weapons on the deck by the airlock and retreat to the engine room. We'll transfer the stolen cargo to the Jandalin, then confirm the hijackers didn't accidentally take a piece or two into the engine room with them.
I hardly think...
If they have... Lapin Six continued. Or if they resist us in any way, we'll lock our two ships together and transport the hijackers to Naperar to face the full horror of death by torture, as specified in the family accords. I expect you to make the consequences of such foolishness very clear in your message to them.
I will,
Roskull said. And Thras could imagine the words coming out from between clenched teeth.
Good,
Lapin Six said, giving Thras a tight smile. We're prepared to record your message. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Chapter 15.
Ornfra was an important economic and political hub of the Ascendancy's northeast zenith sector. All 9 ruling families had strongholds there, as did 17 of the 40 great families. In normal times, it was a thriving and vibrant place, full of life and political intrigue. Right now, it was a major explosion waiting to happen.
Have you figured out what you're going to say to her, Senior Captain?
Apros asked.
I have most of it,
Zyenda said, which was mostly a lie. She actually didn't have the foggiest idea of how she was going to approach Captain Roskull when the Orison finally arrived. For that matter, given Roskull's attitude during their last encounter, she wasn't even sure the other wouldn't simply order her comm officer to refuse any attempt at conversation. But a ship's captain was supposed to look competent to her officers and warriors, whether she felt like she was or not. She scowled out the viewport. The space around Ornfra was buzzing with ships, the transports and merchants skittering around timidly, the patrol craft and warships taking a much more aggressive stand. Most of the general comm conversations the Grey Shrike was picking up were terse and anxious. She looked at the tactical and the prominent icons marking the warships floating watchfully in their various orbits. All of them were from the Dasklo family's private fleet, of course. Ornfra wasn't exactly a private Dasklo province, but it was about as close to one as any planet in the Ascendancy got. The other 8 ruling families had interests here, of course, but they were relatively small, certainly when compared with the Dasklo holdings. The biggest minority presence was probably the Klar and their massive farming operations, which had themselves been a source of low-grade political tussling between the two families for decades. But despite that rivalry, or perhaps because of it, the Klar didn't have any of their own warships here. The overall system patrol was a shared force, as it was on all other Chiss worlds. But with the far more powerful Dasklo warships dominating the system, it was Patriarch Dasklo Irv Orsimi who was calling the shots. And everyone knew it. Normally, that somewhat lopsided arrangement seldom rose above the level of minor annoyance. Now, with tensions heightened and accusations and counter-accusations being thrown around, the whole system seemed poised like an air dancer preparing to launch herself off her chosen cliff. It wasn't just the civilian ships that were acting skittish either. For all their outward confidence, the Dasklo were feeling the strain too. The Greyshrike had already been challenged twice by Dasklo warships, both family commanders demanding to know what an expansionary defense fleet ship was doing in their system. Zyenda had been able to ease their concerns, but from the continual pings of active sensors, it was clear her ship was being watched closely. What those other warships would do when she accosted an incoming Klar warship wasn't a question she wanted to think about. "Basically, I'm just going to explain the situation," she told Apros. "Hopefully, she'll be willing to listen."
"Yes, ma'am," Apros hesitated. "May I ask you a question, Senior Captain?"
"About Captain Roscoe?"
"No, ma'am," Apros said. "Not directly, anyway."
Zyenda gestured.
"Go ahead."
"I've been looking over the Jixtus vid," Apros said, pulling it up on his Questus. "And I was struck by something odd."
He keyed it to play and handed it to her.
"Is it my imagination, or is the cam that's taking the vid moving?"
Zyenda studied the image. Unfortunately, 5 seconds wasn't much time to establish any kind of baseline.
"I assume you've run an analysis on it," she said, handing the Questus back.
"Yes, ma'am, I have," he said, scowling at the image. "It's too short for the computer to make anything of it. But I could swear that the cam is moving past the other ships."